This is State of Opportunity. I'm Jennifer White. Everyone agrees we have to know if kids are learning in school. The current reform movement puts a heavy emphasis on measuring kids' educational progress through high-stakes tests like the MEAP. Some people argue that testing is necessary because it's the best way to measure whether kids and schools are on the right track.
Higher standards are the right goal. Accountability is the right goal.
But others are concerned that high-stakes tests don't really measure whether a child is learning, and that those tests can work against low-income children and children of color.
You know, that number that's attached to you very much has a defining, it is a defining marker.
This hour, we'll explore the world of high-stakes testing. Is it the best way to measure kids' success? And if not testing, then what? We'll also look at whether Michigan is headed in a new direction with testing. That's ahead this hour on State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. You're listening to State of Opportunity here from Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer White. High-stakes tests. Here in Michigan, kids take the MEAP test to measure educational progress. But there is criticism that these tests end up punishing students, particularly kids in low-income communities. While testing has always been a part of education, the role it plays in how we assess kids and schools and how we shape policy has evolved. This hour, we'll look at whether high-stakes tests are working for all kids, and we'll examine the future of testing here in Michigan. And we want to hear from you. Join in on the conversation at 866-255-2762, or you can join the conversation on our State of Opportunity Facebook page. But first, let's hear from educational historian Tracy Steffes about just how tests became so important in the American educational system.
Okay. My name is Tracy Steffes. I'm an assistant professor at Brown University, and I study the history of American education and educational inequality. So since 2001, with No Child Left Behind,
it's time to come together to get it done so that we can truthfully say in America, no child will be left behind, not one single child.
We have regular testing of students according to state tests to see whether they meet proficiency benchmarks. And if they fail, then various sanctions are attached to schools. It is an unprecedented expansion of the federal role in schools in terms of setting requirements and sanctions.
It's time to expect more from our students. It's time to start rewarding good teachers. Stop making excuses for bad ones. It's time to demand results from government at every level.
This is a relatively new development. It comes after over 100 years of using tests as one measure of student learning, but often not the most important. Starting in the 60s, tests took on greater importance, but these were used largely to take the temperature rather than to punish or hold schools accountable. The high stakes aspect didn't really kick in until after the 1980s, and especially with a nation at risk in 1983.
I found that our educational system is in the grip of a crisis.
American schools were suffering a rising tide of mediocrity and threatening the nation.
Caused by low standards, lack of purpose, ineffective use of resources, and a failure to challenge students to push performance to the boundaries of individual ability.
And it focused not just on low-performing students or at-risk students, but argued that the quality of American schools was low across the board and that there needed to be higher standards, more accountability, and more efforts to measure whether schools were reaching these standards.
In my State of the Union address this year, I said that Congress should reform the No Child Left Behind law based on the principles that have guided Race to the Top. And I want to say, the goals behind No Child Left Behind were admirable. Higher standards are the right goal. Accountability is the right goal.
There's a lot of critiques that testing is disadvantaging students in low-income schools, that it's having the high-stakes testing aspect is having a lot of perverse effects, narrowing the curriculum to teach to the test, incentivizing schools to focus on students right above and below proficiency and to ignore others, including those who are very far behind. On the other hand, there's potential for testing to help those students.
That was educational historian Tracy Steffes at Brown University. We also heard the voices, of course, of former Presidents Bush and Reagan and President Obama. So as we heard, testing started as a way to diagnose whether or not low-income kids and kids of color were getting a good education. But just how much of an impact do these tests have now on the kids they were originally designed to help? We're joined in the studio by Brian Jacob, a professor at the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan and a national expert on testing, and Dan Varner, a member of the Michigan Board of Education and CEO of Excellent Schools Detroit. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I want to start just acknowledging the emotion around this issue. We had a comment on our Facebook page from John Henry. He says, testing is ridiculous and serves as one more way to force kids to internalize the idea that our culture values most highly the conformists. Why is this such an emotional issue for people, Brian?
Well, I think one issue is that public education affects all of us, unlike other areas in the public domain. Everyone has been a student. Many people have children in public schools now. There are millions of public school teachers and their families. So really everyone has had a personal experience at one sense, what time or another with the education system.
Dan, you work at both the state level and also in Detroit specifically. Do you come across this kind of emotion in your work?
Absolutely. Maybe the thing that I would add to what Brian shared is that everyone knows, perhaps in part due to the fact that everybody intersects with education at some point in time, that the quality of education you get matters tremendously. And it sets a trajectory for your life in many regards. And so not only does it impact a lot of us, but it's a very important thing in addition.
Brian, so if you can, just to sort of explain the difference between high-stakes tests and the other kinds of tests kids take in school.
Well, high-stakes testing is a very general term, but it basically means a standardized exam that students take that have some important consequences either for the student, him or herself, or for the student's teachers or school or district. And that's distinct from exams that are more formative or diagnostic in nature, which might be used by teachers to understand areas that they need to focus on more with children.
Dan, do you feel these tests are an accurate measure of how kids and schools are doing?
I do, with caveats, of course. And I think that I suspect that most thoughtful observers here would have caveats, and some would actually say, no, they're not at all. But I think they are at some level. So we know that content does matter, right? So you actually have to learn how to read at some point in time. And testing for that is a way of figuring out if, in fact, someone has learned how to read. So I don't think we can afford at all to ignore test results. At the same time, I think a lot of concern around testing stems from what we do with the results. It's not the test itself that is so much the problem, although there are challenges with tests. And I know that you'll get into that conversation a little bit more later. What we do with those test results matters at least as much. And I would argue that a lot of the concern around testing stems from the suspicion on the part of some that what we're doing with those results isn't appropriate.
And some people argue that the stakes are higher for some kids than others. Ryan, in your research, have you found, particularly for low-income kids, that these tests mean more for their educational future?
Well, I think here we have to distinguish between the influence of a student's own test score on his or her own future. And I think certainly they are important to some extent. And in the kind of recent wave of using test scores to determine whether students can proceed to the next grade, they become very, very important. But I think another important way in which tests are important for low-income students is how they affect the teachers in the schools and the district administrators that serve low-income children. And I think here, as the historian mentioned early on, testing really is a double-edged sword. I think there are I completely agree with Dan that the information is invaluable, and I would not want to see kind of going back to a time when we had less information about student performance. At the same time, though, there have been many unintended consequences of testing, individuals gaming the system to try to focus on certain students or narrowing with their curriculum. Yet I think there is also evidence that the testing kind of prompted by No Child Left Behind has led to noticeable improvements in student achievement, particularly among low-income, poor students in the U.S.
Have you found the same thing, Dan, in your work? You're working again at the state level and with schools in Detroit.
Yeah, I would agree that there's tremendous value in the information that we get from tests. Once again, the issue I think is around what we do with that information. I might also point out that so testing is one way of assessing the performance of schools and teachers and administrators assessing the learning of students. But there are multiple ways to do that. It doesn't just have to be high stakes testing. And perhaps part of what we should be discussing as well is kind of other ways to gather information that would supplement the information that we're getting from high-stakes tests. I don't think the solution is to eliminate them altogether. That's just – I agree with Brian that the loss of that information would really do a disservice to all of us who are trying to figure out how to improve educational outcomes for kids.
So just in about 20 seconds, Dan, what would you say is a good tool Michigan could turn to?
Well, there are a number. One of the ones that we like at Excellent Schools Detroit, so removing my State Board of Education hat for a moment, is the Five Essential Survey Tool out of the University of Chicago. It surveys students and teachers across five domains that are proven to associate with school performance over time. So getting teacher and student voice in all of this matters as a quick example.
We've been speaking with Dan Varner, a member of the Michigan Board of Education and CEO of Excellent Schools Detroit, and Brian Jacob, a professor at the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan and a national expert on testing. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, what is the impact of testing on kids? When a child performs poorly on a high-stakes test, does that change how they view themselves as learners? Are we setting kids up to fail on these tests? That's just ahead. And later in the program, Michigan transitions to the Common Core state standards, and Michigan students could be facing a new high-stakes test. Join the conversation at 866-255-2672. Do you think the tests you took in schools were an accurate measure of what you were learning? You're listening to State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. You're listening to State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer White. Today we're talking about high-stakes tests, tests like the MEEP. These tests have an impact on school districts and educational policy, but it can also have a direct impact on individual students. We're joined now by State of Opportunity's Dustin Dwyer. Hi, Dustin.
Hi, how's it going?
Going great. Glad to have you here. Dustin, you're working on a documentary about the third grade MEEP test, and you've been talking to educators and kids about the test, and you spent some time at Congress Elementary School in Grand Rapids.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time there. In fact, about the first 6 weeks of school, from the first day of class until the last day of the MEEP, pretty much all I did was spend my time inside Congress Elementary. And the idea was to get to know the teachers, the principal, the students' families, to see if you spent time inside, say, one classroom, what do you learn about the MEEP? What do you learn about test scores that you wouldn't learn, you know, just by having the discussion outside of the school? And I wanted to give you a little sample of some of the audio that we have. Here's a little bit where I'm asking people about the MEEP. This is, you'll hear the principal of Congress Elementary, Bridget Cheney, and a third grader named Musa.
You're talking about a test that is proficiency-based, and I like to look at growth. So in Grand Rapids Public, we use both. I think proficiency is important, but I think there are a lot of factors that go into education that are not just proficiency-based. I think there are a lot of very successful people out there that may not have been proficient at one time on a high-stakes test.
Why don't you like tests?
Because sometimes you could get the wrong answer, and I don't like that.
You don't like being wrong?
Mm-mm.
Why do you think you have to take tests?
I think to get smarter.
What do you think about the school being judged on the top to bottom ranking? Because you're in the 11th percentile.
11th percentile, correct. Yes, we were in the second percentile. 3 years ago. That 11th percentile speaks volumes to people, because 11th percentile, as compared to somebody not too far from here who's in the 91st percentile, that's huge. You know, that is huge. So I say we can combat that by continuing to do the best that we can and know that we're going to rise. But ultimately, you know, that number that's attached to you very much has a defining, it is a defining marker.
Why do you think they make you do the tests?
Because, I don't know, to get your brain working and stuff. Maybe they make you take the test and then make your brain get working, and then they do all the other learning stuff.
That was Principal Bridget Cheney and her student Musa from Congress Elementary School in Grand Rapids. Dustin, they had completely different understandings of what the MEEP test was about.
Well, that's right. And, you know, a few minutes ago we heard Dan Varner talk about why it matters how we use the results of the test. And we should think that different people use results of tests differently. As a taxpayer, as a citizen in Grand Rapids, I look at test results in one way. My neighbors look at test results in one way. Bridget Cheney looks at test results to decide how to help her students learn better. And so she was evaluating the MEEP on its value there. But she knows that the school is defined by the MEEP results. Even though she is an educator, might not see those results as necessarily the best indicator of where her students are. Whereas Musa, as a student, he just thinks it's just another test I have to do. And the teachers there, teachers everywhere, try to get students to care about the test. But the reality is, it doesn't affect their grade. It doesn't have an immediate impact on them. A lot of times, the teachers at Congress would tell kids, it's a chance to show off what you know. Mm-hmm. So that's what students are getting out of it.
I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation. Valerie Purdy Vons is an assistant professor of psychology and research fellow at the Institute for Research on African American Studies at Columbia University. And she joins us now. Valerie, welcome.
Hello, how are you?
Doing well. Thank you so much for being here. Does your research bear out what Dustin says, that especially for younger kids, while we call these high-stakes tests, they don't really understand what's at stake?
I think there's a difference between whether students, say Musa as a third grader, understands the impact that the test has on him versus the actual impact the test can have on him. And what I mean by that is the research that I and others do as psychologists is to understand underperformance, where students are underperforming below their ability. And there's a pretty compelling evidence that when you are in a situation where there are stereotypes out there about your intellectual ability, which we know are out there about many children of color, that they're seen as not particularly smart, and then you're in a context like a high-stakes standardized test, the sort of knowledge of that stereotype in the moment when you're trying to take that test can depress your test performance.
Explain it a little more, because we're using this term, a stereotype threat. And so what you're saying is that if someone believes that a certain stereotype is true about their group, that will impact how well they take a test?
Yes, except for I would clarify, you don't actually have to believe that the stereotype is true. You just have to be in a context where that stereotype is relevant. And I can give you a couple of examples. You know, I myself, as a African-American student, I played basketball in college. I'm sitting in a class, and I know that there are stereotypes in my philosophy class that African-Americans can't write. I don't believe it, but I'm just in that moment. And the stress that comes with handing in my first philosophy writing assignment, the stress associated with taking the first test in that class, this can actually depress your performance on that particular test. And there's pretty compelling evidence that this can affect children as early as first grade. And so whether or not – and usually I thought it was absolutely fascinating what Musa was saying, because it does, sometimes it leaks out in, I just don't like to take tests, or I feel really nervous when I take tests. But it's a kind of stressor that's associated with one group, and here it's specifically associated with underrepresented students, children of color, low-income students, more than students from majority groups. And so to the extent that the test is not necessarily reflecting students' accurate ability of what they can do, then there's some challenges associated with high-stakes testing.
We're speaking with Valerie Purdy Vaughns, an assistant professor of psychology at Columbia University, and Dustin Dwyer from our State of Opportunity team.
Hi, yeah, Valerie. Yeah, it's really – we keep talking about Musa. I kind of wish he was here now. The thing is, Musa is a great – actually he's a great, really smart kid, one of the smarter kids in the classroom. I don't have access to the student's information, but what's funny to me about what he said is that I think actually that Musa is a great test taker. So can you talk about even students who are advanced, like when we bring expectations to them, or we even take them into a room and say, please do your best on this test, it's going to take a long time or whatever. You know, how does that impact students differently, even if a student thinks of themselves as a smart student, which Musa absolutely does? And he's right about that.
The irony of these kinds of stressors is that you actually have to care about doing well in order for the stress to take hold. So students, of which there are some who don't particularly care about doing well, they just don't do well. That's not underperformance. They just don't do well. But what we're talking about is a kind of stressor that undermines students' ability to thrive, that they should be doing better than they're doing. And so when you take a student who, you know, probably is very strong, very capable of doing well, and then you put them in a situation where they know this test is important, they may not know why it's important, but they may think, I've heard students say, well, my teacher will get in trouble if I don't do well, or my school will look bad, or my school will – they'll take away recess. So they don't exactly understand, but they know that bad things happen as a result of their test scores.
We want to invite – let me just jump in here 1 second. We want to invite you to join the conversation at 866-255-2762 or go to our State of Opportunity Facebook page. Valerie, go on.
Yes. And so when you're so that's one of the components that makes it high stakes. Children know something is at stake. And then also you are a member of a group of which you have this sense that people see you differently in terms of a test taker. It can apply to young girls, particularly in science classes, African-American students, Latino students, Native American students. It can apply to students in the Appalachia, very low income, impoverished students. So any group of there's some really interesting recent research on children with learning disabilities. So almost every student of which there is some kind of stereotype, some kind of sense of otherness about them when they're taking a test, when they're in that moment, the stress associated with knowing or just sort of being aware that there's stereotypes associated with that group can depress their performance. And this is something that I think that districts and states are really not taking seriously in terms of the implications of what these test scores mean.
Well, Dustin, I wanted to get you in here for a second because in your reporting, you're talking to a lot of educators and administrators. Is this an issue that's even on their radar? Is this something they express concern about?
Maybe not in the same way. And, you know, my experience recently this year has been with really one school. And what I can tell you is what they do at that school, which is not – they really try not to put a ton of pressure on kids about this test. That it doesn't really come up for the test. They had a couple of kids on the day of the MEEP who had missed the assembly the day before. They didn't even know they would be taking the test. I think what Valerie's saying is right. They do get a sense that whenever they're in this environment where, you know, the environment is different and they're asked to take a test, they realize that something's happening here and they need to do well on it, and that causes maybe some stress. But as educators, one thing that they did at Congress, and I think a lot of educators do this, is to not try to make the test seem so important, certainly not at that young of an age.
Mm-hmm. Valerie, are we setting kids up into a cycle of poor performance? Is there a possibility that we can get them in this cycle just through taking tests and maybe not performing as well as they think they should?
I think that there certainly is at risk. One of the things that our studies are showing is that depressed performance begets depressed performance. So once you start to not do as well on a particular test, you also don't do as well on your next homework assignment. You also then don't do as well on your next test. And so you start this legacy of underperformance. And so without some kind of intervention, you should see very consistent achievement gaps in a variety of different schools, from elementary school to middle school to high school. And this is really a lot of what our work is showing, that these achievement gaps are much larger and persistent and entrenched as a function of these high-stakes tests.
Dustin, you and I were chatting before the show about not just the tests, but just for kids of color, perhaps, who are in a district that where the teachers are white, the administrators are white, whether that can also set up some issues for them where these tests are concerned.
Well, yeah, I mean, as reporters on the State of Opportunity team, we visited a lot of schools, and we know that in a lot of urban districts, you know, a lot of minority students are taught by white teachers, white principals, and everyone they see who's in a place of authority is different from them. I'm wondering, Valerie, what impact does that have on testing? Not if a stereotype is sort of said to you out loud or it's sort of present in your life, but just the effect of being in an environment where the people around you, the people administering the test, look different from you.
I think that's a fascinating question, and I think the best way to answer that is that it's not so much, you know, the I don't want to use a cliche, the color of your skin versus the content of your character. But what I will say is that that there's sort of two dimensions. One dimension is that if you have a teacher that's different from you, but has somehow communicated in a sincere way that they sort of understand where you're coming from, your environment, perhaps they've done home visits, they're sort of familiar with your community, the sort of racial, ethnic, physical difference is less acute than when you have a teacher who, say, is white, the students are African American or Latino or Native American, and that level of sensitivity isn't there. So the research evidence suggests that a person who's different racially or in terms of gender, men teaching young girls in science, that all that does is that it raises the question to a student, you know, does this person understand me? So it's at that moment, if the teacher can assuage those concerns and say, yes, I do understand you, and there's a variety of different ways that can be done, then those racial differences, those gender differences, those age differences, those class differences don't have the same impact. But without some kind of intervention, they do have an effect.
Well, can I just ask as a follow-up, like, what would you recommend? You know, if I'm a teacher sitting listening, what can I say to my student specifically?
So there's a couple of things. One, there's some really interesting research by Hunter Gelbach, who's at Harvard School of Education, and he's done these what he calls similarity studies, where he gets teachers to share. He gets this whole list of things that the children know about them. They like hot chocolate or whatever. They live in a particular neighborhood, and then they figure out what it is that the teacher shares in common with the students. And this is sort of a very simple technique, and oftentimes it happens organically, where a child will learn that the teacher shares the same birthday, or a teacher comes from the same neighborhood. But they do this explicitly, and creating a sense of shared similarity is one very simple, straightforward way to reduce that gap. That on this particular dimension, you know, you and I like cucumbers, we are the same, so that's one. There are several different kinds of techniques, but that's one of them.
We're speaking with Valerie Purdy Vaughns, assistant professor of psychology at Columbia University. We're also joined by Dustin Dwyer from our State of Opportunity team. And we want you to join in on the conversation at 866-255-2762 or on the State of Opportunity Facebook page. Tell us if the tests you took growing up, if you thought they accurately measured how well you were learning. We want to talk to Carrie in Detroit. Hi, Carrie. Did you have a question? Uh-oh, sounds like we lost Carrie. Her question was about test accuracy, though. I could sort of read the lead up there. Valerie, if a child isn't taking a test seriously, or if they're concerned about their ability to perform well on the test. How much should we depend on these tests as being an accurate measure of how well kids are learning?
I think that's a really difficult question. On the one hand, I guess the way that I think about it as a researcher is that any time you see particularly an underrepresented group and they're not performing well, or you see a fairly consistent gap between how a majority group is doing and a minority group is doing, say men, women in science, you have to account for the fact that some of that difference means that the test is not an accurate measure of that student's ability. And if there are ways to account for that, this is why if there are multiple ways to assess learning beyond just a test, you can start to get a better picture of children.
We've been speaking with State of Opportunity reporter Dustin Dwyer and Valerie Purdy-Vons, Assistant Professor of Psychology and Research Fellow at the Institute for Research on African American Studies at Columbia University. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, education historian Diane Ravitch shares how her thinking about high-stakes testing evolved. We'll also take a look at the impact of changes in high-stakes testing in New York, changes that could be headed to Michigan. That's just ahead. And we want you to join in on the conversation at 866-255-2762. You can also join our Facebook page. Just search for State of Opportunity. You're listening to a special State of Opportunity call-in show from Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer White. This is State of Opportunity from Michigan Radio. I'm Jennifer White. We've been exploring the effect of high-stakes tests on students in schools. Testing has become a major pillar of education policy in the U.S., with many people arguing that it's one of the best tools for measuring kids' progress. But over the course of her career, Diane Ravitch, once a proponent of testing, has substantially changed her opinion of testing. Ravitch is a research professor of education at New York University. She is an author, and her most recent book is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. She joins us now. Diane, welcome.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Diane, you seem to have some issues with the term education reformer. Do you consider yourself a reformer?
Oh, absolutely. When we use the term reformer, we should put quote marks around it or just find a different word because it has nothing to do with public school reform.
What do you think the current reform movement is really about?
Well, the current reform movement is firstly, and you know this very well in Michigan and Wisconsin and many other states, it's about using the rhetoric of reform to actually replace public education with privately managed schools and with the introduction of vouchers. There's way too much reliance on high-stakes testing. High-stakes testing is now being used to change American education in ways that will ultimately be extremely harmful.
But you served as an assistant secretary of education under George H.W. Bush, and at that time, you supported testing and accountability. So what changed?
Well, at the time, I thought that it was a good idea. It hadn't been tried. And so it sounded, in theory, I think it does, as to most Americans, like a good idea. Test kids, test teachers, test everybody, and then use those results to make policy decisions. The problem is, and this is what I've learned over many years, and I'm now way at the end of my career and I guess towards the end of my days, is that the tests just aren't that good. The people's lives should not hinge on a test score. And the test scores of 15-year-olds on an international test say absolutely nothing about the future of our nation. We're using tests in ways that are totally inappropriate, in which the haves feel justified. They think they're smarter and they deserve whatever advantages they have. And the have-nots are pushed even farther to the bottom because they don't have high test scores. And I know that the tests themselves just aren't that good. They make lots of errors.
We're speaking with Diane Ravitch, author of Reign of Error. Some people say, look, we do have school districts that aren't educating kids. They are under-resourced or there are other issues in the district, and we have to have a measure. We have to have a way to see whether kids are progressing. If not testing, then what?
Well, testing can be used as a diagnostic tool. it can be used to say, hey, this is a school district that's in trouble. What do we do about it? Test scores should be used for support, for diagnosis, not for punishment and not for rewards. Take away the high stakes, and testing actually has value.
Diane, let me ask you. You said earlier in our conversation that you've been in this work for a very long time, and you feel like you may be coming towards the end of your career. Looking at your own evolution, if you could say something to yourself, to the Diane Ravitch who served under George H.W. Bush, what would you say to yourself then that you think you know now?
Well, I guess the first thing I would do would be to grab me by the shoulders. I mean, understand I'm 75 years old now, so I was served in the George W. Bush administration in 1991 to 93. I would shake myself by the shoulders and say, why do you believe that the tests are even valid? I mean, what I saw serving as a member of the National Assessment Governing Board, the federal panel, was that we never learned anything new. The test scores always came back showing the same thing. They always came back showing that the children whose parents went to college had higher test scores. The kids who came from affluence had higher scores than the kids who came from poverty. That's true not just in the U.S., it's true in every country in the world. The question with test is, and I would say this to that the older self, what do you do with them? What signals do you take to say, this is how we fix the problem?
We've been speaking with Diane Ravitch, a research professor of education at New York University. She's also the author of 11 books. The most recent is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement, and The Danger to America's Public Schools. She joined us from her home in Brooklyn. Diane, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Jennifer. Bye-bye.
So what's next for Michigan? As the state moves to Common Core, could we also be moving to a new high-stakes test? And what did that transition mean for kids in states like New York that have already moved to Common Core and a new test? Still with us is Dustin Dwyer from our State of Opportunity team, and we're also joined by Julie Zuckerman, principal of Castle Bridge School in New York. Welcome back, Dustin, and welcome to you, Julie.
Thanks so much.
Dustin, quickly, here in Michigan, we're moving to Common Core. That could mean we're moving away from the MEAP to a new test. What's happening right now?
Well, I think one thing to know that's important for people in Michigan to know is that here we are 10 months away from when the MEAP would be scheduled to take in the fall. And I don't think this may have happened in the last few days, but I don't think school districts have been informed yet whether they're taking the MEAP next year. Have they?
I don't believe so. And I know a new MEAP hasn't been written.
And it hasn't been written. So the idea with the new Smarter Balance test would be that it would be taken in the spring. But the real problem for schools right now is that they don't know what the testing regime will be. You know, protest, anti, whether you're for the test or against the test, we're creating real uncertainty with our schools right now.
Julie, New York moved to Common Core, but your school has a really interesting story because your parents decided not to take the test. Who drove that decision? The parents, the teachers, you?
Well, the decision was taken by the parents. The situation was that the city and actually the state had said that all of the K-2 schools, which didn't have third through fifth graders that would be tested, those children had to take a bubble-in math test in October. So kids who couldn't read, couldn't hold a pencil, were supposed to find their way around on a page and answer things that, to be perfectly honest, if you gave them to a fourth grader, the fourth grader would have a hard time doing it. It seemed like a complete waste of time to me. I told the parents that this was coming, and they just took it upon themselves to opt out. So they educated themselves amongst themselves and gave me opt-out letters. When we got to 80%, I canceled the test at that point. I wouldn't have given the test anyway, but it's certainly easier for everyone if the parents have chosen to opt out.
Also joining us now is Amber Arellano, Executive Director of Education Trust Midwest. Amber, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
I'm hoping, Amber, you can give us a little more insight into what could be ahead for Michigan students. We're looking at moving away from the MEAP and moving towards the Smarter Balanced test. How is that test different from the MEAP?
Well, you know, the MEEP has been a test that many educators and parents have been unhappy with for many years now. It's the kind of test that if you ask a parent like myself or many members of my team, you know, it would be the kind of test they'd say, that's not the kind of test that I want my child to take. It's a measure of shallow, broad learning. And so it actually incentivizes teachers to rush through material, rush through, you know, learning and teaching through a semester, rather than focusing on deep knowledge, critical thinking, analytic skills, the kind of skills that students today need to succeed in a knowledge economy. So the test that we're moving toward is very different. It's considered a 21st century test that really is supposed to, and we and believe will, give parents and educators much more valuable information on how college and career ready their children are, and not just in 11th grade when we normally say a child would take an ACT test, but even as early as 6th grade. You know, in places like Tennessee, they have these rich, diagnostic, thoughtful state assessments that can actually provide parents early on in a child's K-12 career diagnostic information about how well that student is doing. So, for example, in sixth grade, that assessment could actually tell us a parent how on track is my child to perform on the ACT in 11th grade? Is my child on track to graduate from high school and be ready to do to get a good job right out of high school? Is she or she ready to perform well and succeed in college? And so this is a very different kind of assessment, and we believe it'll provide a much more reliable, valuable diagnostic information so that we can intervene in kids' lives, especially when they're far behind. And in too many of our urban schools, that's the case and for so many of our kids.
Julie, your parents opted out of this test. You clearly had some strong feelings about the most recent test that was presented to you. But how do you feel about testing as a tool in general? Do you have an issue with testing?
Well, I have an issue with the way that tests are used. Back when I was in school, which is 1,000 years ago, we were tested every other year. I don't see any reason why we can't go back to that. It gives you some kind of understanding of what's going on in the schools, but it's not something that takes over the curriculum of the school. There are schools all over the place where the teachers design their whole curriculum so that the kids will be able to answer whatever's on the test. And that then, since the tests are reading and math, it leaves everything else out. There are plenty of ways to find out what kids do, and the best way is to ask the teacher or ask the child. But people don't trust teachers. They don't trust principals. And instead of going into the schools and seeing for yourself what's going on there, they think that by looking at some test scores, they're going to have a good enough idea of what's happening in the school to be able to help the school, and that's just not the case.
And Amber, this teacher-principal question, that this is a real issue in Michigan. As Dustin said earlier, you know, we're 10 months out from when tests would usually be taken here in Michigan, and we're still not certain what test that's going to be. So how are teachers to prepare their kids for any test, much less a new one when they haven't received training on Smarter Balanced?
You know, we are on track as a state to take Smarter Balance in the fall, starting next school year, which would be the spring of 2015. And the Michigan Department of Education has been preparing for that. There are school districts and educators around the state that have actually been preparing for Smarter Balance for 2 and even 3 years. The Grand Rapids Public Schools have been training their teachers and principals for Smarter Balance over the last 2 years, have spent millions of dollars. I spoke with a wonderful education leader in Washtenaw County yesterday, and she was saying how excited many of the teachers are in her county, that they feel there's real buy-in into Smarter Balance, that this is a rich set of standards around Common Core that's going to really help them, and there's all these wonderful instructional materials that they're using, and they feel like they're digging into this and getting ready, and they're excited. I think the concern is that the Michigan legislature could once again derail the train tracks that we've already been on for a long time now in many places, and actually prevent Michigan from transitioning to a new, much more modern and thoughtful and helpful state assessment. You know, just to keep in mind, our current state assessment is from 1969. Mm. It was built for an industrial model. And, you know, I'm sure as Principal Zuckerman could tell you that in the old days and previous decades, tests were often used to sort kids. And they weren't used for good things. They were used to put kids on tracks for either college or technical or, the lower tracks, that kids that weren't expected to go to college or to get a good job, and particularly low-income students and kids of color. And they weren't used intentionally. They weren't used thoughtfully. And I think some of the issues that Julie has raised are certainly valid. I mean, we have to be careful about we want to use tests for the right reasons, and we want to use appropriate tests that are grade level appropriate, that are thoughtful, and we don't want to do too much testing. Mm-hmm. In some districts, and parents have been voicing frustration that in some districts they've actually been overcompensating with the fact that we've had such a weak state assessment for so many years. And so they've added all of these locally developed or other kinds of assessments. And so, then kids are taking a test, practically every month or every few months just once a year.
I want to bring Dustin into this for a moment.
Yeah, I wanted to say just from what Amber said is also what I've learned, reporting inside of school, is that teachers have been preparing for the change to Common Core standards for a long time. And I wonder, sometimes when I hear the discussion that's happening in policy circles in Lansing and Washington about Common Core, if many of our legislators know that. That the teacher, in many cases in the classroom, the change has already been made. I mean, they're already changing the curriculum. But to what Amber was saying, that the shortfall of the MEAP, using it as a diagnostic tool doesn't work very well for educators, so they do end up giving more tests to different tests so they can use. And I wanted to ask Julie, what do you use? How do you know whether your students are learning, other than just talking to the teacher? How do you know for sure what content your students have mastered within any given year?
Well, I meet with the teachers once a week. I am in the classrooms each week. I have feedback from the teachers four times a year about what the children's reading levels are and what kind of progress there is. We speak on at least each week about the kids that we're concerned about. So we're looking at a progression of skills, both in math and in reading, that we want the kids to be able to gain mastery of, and those are things that we're pursuing at the same time as we're pursuing arts and phys ed and the rest of life, that these skills are in service of.
Amber, I want to ask you in Jesse's final moments, how close is Michigan to making a decision on this test? I know there have been hearings this week. Do we know whether Smarter Balanced is going to be the test, or are we any closer to a decision about that?
I think so. But you raise a really good point. The legislature has been getting involved in education decisions in a way that really is unprecedented in Michigan, and had asked last year if they could approve the funding for the Smarter Balanced assessments that we're on track to implement this coming school year. And so they're really asserting that influence in this decision. And, will we know for sure if they approve the funding? We probably won't know until possibly as late as May 1st or June 1st.
Well, I want to say thanks to Amber Arellano, Executive Director of Education Trust Midwest, Julie Zuckerman, Principal of the Castle Bridge School in New York, and of course, State of Opportunities, Dustin Dwyer. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a special State of Opportunity show from Michigan Radio. You can continue to share your thoughts with us on Facebook. Just search for State of Opportunity or tweet us at State of Op with two P's. State of Opportunity was produced and directed by Sarah Alvarez and Allie Billings with help from Zoe Clark and Kimberly Springer. The program was engineered by Bob Scon. Tamar Charney is the executive producer. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jennifer White.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.